Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past 2021. The Historical Novel Society Australasia acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live. We pay respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. In this season of Imagining the Past, we'll take a sneak peek at writers and issues showcased at this year's Historical Novel Society Australasia's virtual conference, which will be held over two successive weekends on the 16th and 17th of October and the 22nd to 24th of October 2021. The online conference offers boot camps and craft workshops, with the main conference program featuring 2 days of interviews, panels and chat salons for both writers and readers of historical fiction. For more information, please visit hnsa.org.au. In our upcoming podcast, I'll be chatting with some of the conference guests about their work and their inspirations. So pop on the kettle, pop on your headphones, and let's start imagining the past. Mirandi Rewo's Stone Sky Gold Mountain won the inaugural ARA Historical Novel Prize and the Queensland Literary Award, and was shortlisted for the Stella Prize and longlisted for the Miles Franklin Award. Mirandi has a PhD in Creative Writing and Literary Studies from Queensland University of Technology. I start by welcoming her to Imagining the Past.
Thank you for having me.
I'd just like to start with, what was the first kind of inkling that you had to become a writer?
You know, I've always been an avid reader. My mother is a huge reader. So I started out from memory loving like Enid Blyton, the, you know, mysteries like The Secret Seven and The Famous Five. And then I sort of moved on to Nancy Drew. So I always liked that sort of mystery kind of fictions. And I do remember when I was about 8 or 9, my dad kept it actually. I wrote a little book and I, you know, drew the illustration on the cover, and it was called The Invisible Pianist. And it had a picture of, you know, hands on a keyboard. And it was like a Tanya Chandler mystery. So I had it all like, you know, this character I wanted to write about. She was, Nancy Drew was a lawyer's daughter, so Tanya Chandler was a doctor's daughter, and she would get cases through the doctor's patients, that sort of thing, like what Nancy Drew did with her father. And then, so I guess I always had this idea that I wanted to be a writer, but sort of life got in the way. I just kept on toddling along, and it wasn't until I was in my 30s, I had little kids, and I was just talking one day about, you know, one day when I write a book, or one day when I'm a writer or whatever. And my mum, who I think always wanted to be a writer, she took me aside and said, you know, Mirandi, stop talking about it, like get started, like actually get started on it. So, you know, so you're not still talking about it, say, in 10 years time. So that was really, really good, timely advice. And that's probably when I first started to, my uncle gave me a laptop, and I puddled around, I think, with a writers group first here in Brisbane, and then I took myself off to uni and did some subjects in creative writing, which moved on into a master's and a PhD.
Wow, I've always loved The Famous Five too. I always thought George had another story that she wasn't quite telling us at that time.
Yeah, I know. And I think he did. But yes, very cool characters, I thought. Yeah.
So how did you then kind of get from that point to writing about 19th century history?
Yeah, that was a long road. I am not like naturally a historical reader or writer. Although I used to love, my mum also had all Georgette Heyer novels, so we used to love reading them, and obviously Austen's and, you know, whatever. But what happened is for my master's I'd written, so what I actually wanted to write originally was crime fiction. So for my master's I wrote, I sort of researched Indonesian crime fiction and wrote a contemporary novel set in Java, like, but in contemporary times, a murder mystery. And then from that, I moved into my PhD, and I was interested in writing about crime fiction, but maybe sort of with an erotica element. But simply because that year, you know, at Byron Bay, a lot of the events revolved around 50 Shades of Grey, how huge it was that year, and how publishers were looking for the same sort of thing, and republishing other, you know, old erotica and everything. But look, so and that's when I thought of, you know, I'd really like her to work maybe with, you know, do some sort of sex work, you know, to sort of work in this erotic element to the crime fiction, because you're always trying to find a new angle, especially like, say, in crime fiction, you know. And then I thought, well, I could make her a courtesan. You know, Victorian London always seems popular in crime fiction, because at the time they'd rehash that Whitechapel and, you know, Sherlock Holmes. So I thought, well, maybe she could be a Eurasian woman who hides that she's Eurasian. She can't actually be in, you know, show that she's part Asian, but and that she's a courtesan, which is the sort of highest strata of sex work. And they're very fascinating characters anyway. So it didn't take me long to realize I couldn't actually write the erotica component, so the whole thing changed. So then I rolled into a PhD, and what I looked at was Neo-Victorian fiction, and it had three rules, I guess. One was that it needed to be authentic, but it also needed to be marketable, and also have, I guess, resonance for contemporary readers, which is probably authenticity, and the resonance is probably what I've taken through with me on most of my historical work, in that I don't write about the past sort of in a homage kind of way. I write about it in a way that either I can maybe reveal things from that period that haven't been explored or written about enough, purely because of who did bring us that history and the first place, which is usually classed and gendered, you know, and also as a sort of reflection on what hasn't changed enough. So I can, you know, even in my historical fiction, I can look back at what, you know, like racist attitudes that really haven't changed that much, or even sexist attitudes that haven't really changed that much, you know, especially to do with violence against women, that sort of thing. So they're the sort of things I looked at in my PhD. I also looked at the Asian population of London, and it was very small, but it did exist, and how sort of Limehouse and the sinister Oriental was really a product of fiction, you know, like Dickens and Fu Manchu, you know, all, you know, Sherlock Holmes even, how they kind of framed what, you know, the sinister Orientals you could find in Limehouse. So what I wanted to do was sort of write about some characters in Victorian London who are living a more sort of normal life, as opposed to that sort of sinister lifestyle. And I also looked at sort of like, I guess, feminist crime fiction and crime fiction from the period that was written by women and featured women. That's sort of how I got into the Victorian period, actually, was through the courtesan. And I mean, it was quite terrifying, because, and I would say for the first year, I did just straight research on that period. And I also went to London and checked out like everywhere I needed to, my character would have lived or been, you know. And I was telling this story last night, actually, to a class. I did my year of research, and it's really hard. I mean, I knew what I wanted the story to be, but it is confronting, I guess, with, you know, especially when you're researching, it's really quite never ending, you know. You have to make a start somewhere, and it's overwhelming. So I went away for the Christmas holidays, and I was reading a book on how to be creative. And this woman said, you know, write your fears down, like in a diary. So I wrote my fears, and one of them was, I will never be able to write in a historical fiction. And then a year went past. It was the second year of my PhD. And I went back to the same holiday spot, And I found that diary and I opened it and they said, oh, I'll never be able to write a historical fiction. But the brilliant thing was that by then I'd finished the first draft. It worked out really nicely. But that sort of took me to the Victorian period. And I guess from that, I now have a really good sort of base for my further novels, you know. Yeah.
So it's quite a path from Victorian England, though, to the goldfields of far north Queensland. How did that come about, and what was the first kind of inklings you had around Stone Sky, Gold Mountain?
Yeah, I guess what it was so I was already writing about part sort of Chinese characters. And I guess what happened is I realised because my father's Chinese Indonesian, I realised I wanted to write about the same sort of things, like the cross-cultural relationships and everything, but for an Australian audience, set in Australia, you know. So and I've always loved hearing about those Eurasian families, you know, of a Chinese man and a white Australian woman who got together, say, in the 1860s or whatever, and how their family still exists now, you know, and those families, the descendants are so proud of this line usually. And I mean, I'm sure along the line there were sort of incidents or times that they weren't so proud, you know, via like the white Australia policy and racism and everything. So I've always been really interested in how that initial couple met and defied maybe racist attitudes, or maybe didn't even come across them if they were in some country town that was accepting, you know. So I was always interested in sort of exploring that cross-cultural relationship. But what happened is then I thought, well, and then the obvious place to start was the gold rush. So, and there were Chinese here earlier, you know, like trading and that sort of thing, but, or even coming over as shepherds and things, you know, and workers. But the gold rush, just, I guess, you're looking too at what you can research. So the gold rush is really rich. And originally I started with Victoria. I made a few trips to Victoria, like to Bendigo and Ballarat and the brilliant sort of museums that they have in Melbourne itself. And, but I guess there's so much known about those gold rushes that I was a bit hesitant using Victoria, and I'm from Queensland as well anyway. And then my husband's from North Queensland. He's also a geologist. So he was sort of like, well, why don't you try some of the Queensland gold rushes? And we sort of worked our way up north, you know, like via Gympie, and we went a bit further and a bit further until we got to, you know, even around Cairns. But anyway, eventually we hit Cooktown. And the beauty of Cooktown was, like, it's tiny now, but at the time it was much bigger, and a lot of the businesses were run by Chinese. And then Maytown, and they've got all the information there in their two museums. Maytown itself was a sort of thriving little township. It had a lemonade factory, it had a post office, it had, you know, shops and everything. Again, a lot of Chinese people there working there, owning the businesses. But the great thing for me as a writer was that there's nothing there now. Like, if you go there, it's just a dirt road. There's stumps where the post office was, bricks from where the bakery was. And they put some plaques in where the shops were, naming where the shops were. So that was really great for me as a writer, because then I could sort of people and home and describe the township for myself, but on that, you know, on the parameters I already had.
Right. How many Chinese people did come to the Gold Rush Fields, and were they from similar areas of China or from
all
over?
Yeah, so apparently there were up to 20,000 Chinese in the area at that time. So this is the 1870s. So
wow.
Up to 20,000. So yeah, like, and apparently, like, even in Cooktown, all the butchers and that were run by them, except for one butcher, which was run by an Australian, you know, a white Australian family. In Maytown, you know, on those plaques, you'll see that a lot of the shops were owned by Chinese people. They and there were up to, say, 5,000 white Australians in the area. So they were actually outnumbered by the Chinese.
Wow.
Which I just find amazing, because you wouldn't know it. Like, it's not something that has come down.
Well, I think this is one of the great things of historical fiction, is that it can lay bare all of these things that we just haven't been told and don't know.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of people, isn't it?
That's a lot. Yeah, that is a lot. And I guess that's why I write Miriam, like, she notices. I mean, you would notice. And racist or not, you would probably feel, you know, a bit overwhelmed by it, I guess, if you're in a small space with a people that is so unfamiliar to you, you know, culturally and even the way they look and dress. So the Chinese themselves, they came from mostly from the southern parts of China. And of course, at the time in China, there were, you know, there was terrible famine going on. There was little wars that were happening in China. There's a lot of violence. So, and just the poverty. So what we had was a situation mostly of, I guess, like human trafficking. Like, they would pay a fee to some head honcho who would, or they would take out a loan, and you'd be promised work here, and you'd pay off your ticket or your loan, or there was a license the Australians made Chinese get. So it works a lot like, you know, the same old thing, like you go to another country and you become like a servant or work somewhere on a work site, and you work there until you've paid it off and you send a bit home to your family. It was that sort of thing even back then. So
it's very similar to the situation with the Kanak people that were brought from the islands to the cane fields and then, you know, sent back.
Yeah. And there were different, I guess there were different levels. Like, some people were just families who decided to come here. Like, the one diary I read was the son of a Chinese man and his brother, that the three of them came over. And you stay with sort of your own clan group, because then there were heaps of different clan groups with different dialects, which I don't go into in the novel, because that's just, it's just another story then altogether, you know. But they had all different dialects. So there was Cantonese and there was Hokkien and there were Hakka and there were people from, you know, even Shanghai, say, who came down. And at one stage, a bit later than my novel, there was a big riot between, now I've read different versions, like whether it was the Hakka against the Hokkien or the Cantonese against the, you know, Macau people. But so there were two factions, and they had this battle in a place called Lucansville, and the police kind of, the white, you know, Australian police tried to stay out of it kind of, but word was that there were probably quite a big number of deaths in it, like maybe even more than Eureka, that sort of thing. But it hasn't been
told.
I guess established, it hasn't been written about, because it was just kept within the Chinese community. So there were those sort of tensions, but what I did is I read a book about the Tong Wars in San Francisco, I believe, like in Los Angeles, that sort of thing, to get a feel for the tensions that can happen between the groups. But like I said, I don't go into it in my novel, because it just is another story, and it would have bogged the novel, you know, because, you know, if I had to go into, so mostly I've made my characters sort of more sort of just Cantonese, I guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't go into all the different dialects they would have spoken.
So the novel's told through three parallel narratives where, time is pretty much sequential. They might kind of overlap slightly. Have you kind of tried using this before, and was it hard to juggle the separate streams?
Yeah, originally I just wrote the novel. Usually I will write a novel sequentially, like I'll start at A and I'll go through to Z. And I'd started probably just a bit of Ying, a bit of a brother, maybe a bit back to Ying. Then we went to Miriam, back to Ying. Like that's sort of how I sort of just started writing it. And I think it was quite early on when I got the contract with UQP, and it was Aviva, my publisher, who suggested maybe it would be good if it was like ABC, 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 ABC all the way through. So that was good to know in the beginning, because then I could, and I'm a big planner. Like I'm not a pantser. I will plot. So I could work with that. But with Liu's section, so usually I will just go ABC, ABC, ABC when I write, but with Liu's section, I knew I needed his tension, because he goes off alone. I needed his tension to be sort of unbroken, I guess, like his trajectory was just one trajectory, you know? So I had a residency. I was lucky enough to get a residency in Shanghai, and I used that time to write just his journey, like what happened to him. So I could just work on, you know, like the tensions of, you know, what was happening to him, how his life was sort of unraveling without my, I guess, momentum in writing him broken up by the girl, the young women. So, and then what happened is I came back to Australia, and I then got back to doing Ying and Miriam's sections and sort of worked his in. But I did have to, so at the end of writing the whole thing, it did become a bit tricky in the end, because then I had to, even though Liu was away, you know, on, you know, like on the sheep station and things, I had to make sure his section sort of lined up with the women's sections, as far as say weather and everything went, or that it was nighttime, daytime, that sort of thing. So that it was, so they did sort of tie into each other. And then in the end too, I had to add a few sections even after I'd finished. And then, you know, they thought, my editor thought maybe that it'd be good if there are just three more little sections, just filling in some, you know, some of the, at the end. So that was a bit tricky again, you know? So yeah, but it was doable. It's doable, but it is tricky getting it all sort of entwined neatly.
Well, it sounds like you've, use two strategies really, and then had to plat them all together.
Yes.
I just wonder, was there a risk that you'd lose suspense, you know, particularly between the two women, because their stories are much more in the same place and the same time. So I just kind of wondered if you felt like you had the risk of losing suspense because we were in both points of view.
No, I think by the time I was writing them, if anything, it would have helped with suspense because I could have them playing off each other, not just, you know, terrible events sort of pushing things along like poor old Liu. So, no, I think actually because they could feed in off each other, because by then Liu had left and it was just the two of them and their story, I think actually that worked well. I think that left me room to just work on their stories and entwining the stories. Yeah.
And all three of the narratives are written in third person point of view, but they're all in present tense. I'm just wondering what your process was to choose to use present tense and what you felt that afforded you.
Yeah, I know present tense irritates some people, especially in historical fiction. I like present tense because it ties in with what I was saying before about, even though my books are set in the past, I'm actually trying to look at some issues, you know, to do with now, like, and, you know, especially say in the last 18 months, we can see sort of an increase in racism against the Chinese and that sort of thing. So I feel writing a book that's so clearly in the past, but writing it in present tense gives us more immediacy to those characters. Like, we don't feel like they're characters from another time or another place that you can feel disconnected from, and you actually feel less empathy for maybe as well. So I just feel like present tense gives it the immediacy that I would like for because I want it to read like a contemporary novel, but it's set in the past, if you know what I mean.
You don't feel like you could have achieved that by using a first person narrative?
Now, first person, I would have felt that was really odd if I'd done three different characters in first person. If it was all the one book from one person's point of view, then first person would be fine. I don't love the third person, third person, third person, third person. You know, that one gets the first person. I think three first persons would not have worked for me at all. But I think that comes down to taste as a writer. I think writers usually have a taste with whether they like first person or third person better, just to write it. And I don't write a lot of first person. Actually, the Heloise novels, the crime fiction, I did write, originally they were all in third person. So when I wrote them originally, they were in third person past tense, which really is the most common thing. And then I thought, no, they just seemed so old fashioned, I guess. I changed them to present tense, which seemed to, you know, seemed to help with the pace. Like it really made it more pacey. And then I changed it to first person for Heloise, the main character. I changed her to first person, and it immediately gave me more sort of intimacy and intimacy into her character. Like it immediately gave me more. You could connect to her more. So she is in first person. But no, I wouldn't have done it in a book with three characters.
Yeah, I think that's right, that you, by having them all in third person, there is kind of a veneer that or a shell that kind of does make them into a whole. I'm just wondering what your primary research methods were and what your primary sources were. Did you have to, with Australian newspaper reporting, kind of work on the negative side of the article so that you could kind of read into the cracks of history?
It was surprisingly easy to, you know, you'd just be reading firsthand accounts or reports of, like, you know, finding that Palmer River area and or some of the earlier diggers there. And I mean, the hardship, but also the racism and how they felt and how they treated or felt about the local Kuku Yalanji people is just there. Like, it's, you know, when I first started writing this novel, it was supposed to be just sort of this love story between, you know, sort of cross-cultural love story between the two characters. But, you know, just reading anything you're going to research back to, you know, these first-hand accounts, you just can't get past the discrimination and I guess the displacement and the deaths of what happened, you know, to the Aboriginal people there. And I just knew once I'd done the research, there's, you know, and the attitudes you're reading, there was no way it could then just be a simple love story, I found. Yeah. And so what I did is I took a lot of those first-hand accounts and I wrote them. So there's a few scenes in the book where I've taken, say, a white man's account of what happens up north, and I've just switched it to one of my Chinese characters, you know, experiencing it or looking on something that one of the white men have reported on.
Were there first-hand Chinese accounts, though? Were there many of those? Like, was there a Chinese press newspaper at the time?
Well, there were probably a bit later. There were, definitely, because also there were movements to against the government and the discrimination the Chinese migrants did experience, you know, like in paying higher licenses and that than people from Europe and everything. So they did form like I think like unions or would have a club where they would write these letters and dispute things. But I did mostly, I went by a Tansy is a writer. Well, he's not a writer. He's the one I was talking about before who came with his father and his brother. And after the gold rush and everything, they established a shop. And then and he talks about that. And so it's sort of like, I guess, a autobiography that he's written, a memoir. And so I did read that, and because he had great, information on like just how hard it was to make that track from Cooktown to the Palmer River and all the horrible things that happened, like even, their shoulders would bleed from carrying those poles and things like that. So a lot of that sort of information came from his memoir, actually.
Yeah, those first-hand accounts are always the gems to find, which is why I always try and encourage people to write down their memories of things that have happened and have them filed away, because they're absolutely gold to find, really.
Yeah, and there are, I also met a fellow in Shanghai, and it was totally coincidental, but his great grandfather was totally coincidental, and I just happened, somebody said, oh, you should meet blah blah blah, he has da da da, but I thought he was related to Billy Singh, but then it came out that actually his great grandfather was one of the shop owners in Maytown, one of those first ones, and he has a park there. And his pictures up in the museum and everything. Anyway, he had, he had all the stories. Like he was magnificent. And he writes down the stories and has photos and everything. So he was another source. Like he was amazing, amazing information from him.
Yeah, it's great, those serendipitous meetings.
Oh my gosh, that was really amazing, actually. Yeah.
So what was the process to arrive at the gender bending female lead? It's quite is there a lot of evidence that Chinese women lived in this manner?
No, so Chinese women weren't really Chinese women here, because I think even at a census around that time there were three in Australia. I think because the Australians didn't want Chinese women coming over because they didn't want the Chinese men to settle. And the Chinese themselves didn't want the women coming over because it was just so rough and horrible here. So, no, I don't actually have any evidence of somebody doing what Ying does. In the beginning, when I decided to make her a girl, it simply was because I wanted to write about a female character. So that was just down to, what I wanted to do as the author. I did look into women who had spent their lives as men in the past. And a lot of them, what's amazing is a lot of them were actually like in the Navy or, like in wars and things, and it wasn't until when they were, had an autopsy once they died that people realized they were, female. So these are just really amazing stories. And also, you would wonder, there's so many restrictions on women. You would wonder, and what's funny is, at the same time, thank God, the same month that my book came out, that other Pam Zhong's book came out in America called How Much of These Hills Are Gold?
I think.
And it's have you read it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my gosh. So it's set around the same time as my book, but in America, in the Wild West. Hers is much more sort of Wild Westy, and it's two Chinese siblings, but they're girls. But one of them dresses as a boy, like and goes off and lives life as a man. And the sister, she does her thing. And yeah, there were just so many parallels. And I just, it's interesting. I guess unless you're Calamity Jane or something like that, maybe it was a way that women, especially say as a writer, that you can get a woman to maybe be doing, to be more active in the story, because I probably couldn't have had her there on the Gold Rush as a girl.
Well, it recalls Singer's Yentl the Yeshiva Boy, which is a similar story, in that, you know, Yentl had to disguise herself as a male just to achieve education. So there's a long kind of history of that.
Yes, exactly. But I think hers was more, so for Ying, it was more accidental. It was more that she just needed to stay with her brother, and so they dressed up as a boy. And then I think, as opposed to Miriam, I think for Ying, Ying's a very sort of accepting character. She is curious. She engages with everything around her. I really like Ying, and I think what she has with Miriam is just a reflection of her open-mindedness and open-armedness, you know. Yeah.
Well, they both do have to overcome kind of prejudices or preconceptions, really, for their friendship to move forward. I mean, Miriam's, you know, overcoming racial prejudices, and Ying knows the truth, but, you know, has to kind of overcome those conceptions around gender and things.
Yeah.
It seems to really heighten and kind of reconfigure the romance trope in the novel. The stakes, you know, they're pretty high.
Yeah. I feel for Ying, she doesn't think about it that much. For her, she's just, you know, attracted to who she is. Miriam, like you said, I think she had to overcome sort of how she felt about the Chinese anyway, which I think is indicative, I guess, of people who, you know, might be racist and might become less racist if they actually get to know somebody, or maybe they stay racist, but they're, you know, they're still friends with one, you know, Chinese, that sort of thing. And I did feel with Miriam, if I was to go the whole hog on the story, like, you know, that there were revelations, that sort of thing, I felt again, so this is something I had to sort of decide on early on when I was writing the novel. I felt again that would be a different book, that would have had to explore different themes. And so I'd never, I felt Miriam, probably her prejudices had been pushed enough. I don't know that Miriam could have gone much further.
When I was researching for Sweet Bitter Cane, I found a lot of newspaper articles that were written in the 1920s about the Italians buying up the best land in far north Queensland, sending the money back to Italy, working in an isolated manner, not integrating. But, you know, the obvious other side to that was they were provided no encouragement to integrate. But it just felt like if I replaced Italian with Iraqi or Iranian and Catholicism with Islam, the articles were terribly contemporary. Mm-hmm. I just kind of wonder if you ran into that, and also if you feel like just history has taught us nothing.
I don't think history has taught us nothing. I think we've definitely moved on, but perhaps frustratingly not enough. Like it becomes quite frustrating when you see, like, you know, I think, say, racism in Australia has certainly come in cycles. I think maybe my son, say, in the last 5-10 years, probably experienced more racism, like, you know, than I would have in the 70s and 80s, which is strange when you think about it. So I think the cycle, it sort of ebbs and flows, like the racism. So I guess you're right in that it is that same sort of looking at things in the past, and I guess rather than it just being, you know, now it's Iraqis and everything, I guess I'm just looking at how the Chinese were treated then, and it's the same rhetoric now. You know, it's the same rhetoric. They're going to take our land, they're going to take our jobs, they're going to take over the world, they're threatening. So I just feel it is a bit frustrating that you can write about the same things. And even like the racist scene in the book was taken from something I YouTubed that happened, 3 years ago.
I just wonder too, with food, I feel in Australia is always, because it's palatable, literally, has always kind of formed a bit of a bridge for other cultures to come in, you know, particularly when you've got people like Charmaine Solomon and Margaret Fulton writing cookbooks that were, you know, highly exotic at the time they were published. When Ying offers Miriam the sea cucumber, she refuses to eat it because it is just too exotic. I just wonder if you were hinting there at the kind of narrow bands of acceptance that Australia kind of has around cultural identification.
No, I think that probably came more from a personal point of view. I can see what you're saying. Like, say it's like the Chung Sam, that girl at the formal wearing a Chung Sam a few years ago, a white American girl. And I could see the argument. Like, I personally don't mind who's wearing a Chung Sam, but I can see the argument that, you know, it's like food or beautiful clothing's acceptable, but they don't accept the people, the actual people. I think I have tried to write about that. I think when it comes to the sea cucumber, though, it was more probably came from a personal space of, you know, when I've been with friends, say, and or even, you know, say the sort of Western side of my family, and where they're sort of grossed out about something that you really think's delicious, and they're grossed out, that kind of feeling of embarrassment you get yourself, like that you really love this gross thing, and they don't, you know, and it's actually a bit embarrassing. And is that like a defect of, you know, mine or whatever? So that was probably just more personal than actually any message there behind the food. And in fact, there are some things, you know, I'm not keen on sea cucumber myself.
I guess for the relationship between Miriam and Ying to work to the limited extent it does, they both have to transcend at least gender and race. I'm just wondering if you think of an author and who's doing their job well, does the author become ageless, genderless, and raceless?
If they're doing their job well.
Well, if they've done their research.
And... yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how to answer that, because I would say when I approach books, it's the opposite. Like, I'm definitely writing from a place of gender and culture, and soon enough it will be from age as well. Because I'd be, you know, I'm exploring concepts to do with things that I think about, you know, that I can explore, and possibilities, and revealing like inaccuracies or prejudices. So maybe in a literary sense you're right, and it should be, you know, genderless and, you know, culturally, you know, less. But no, I would find I always write from those points.
Well, thanks for your time today. Just to finish up, I'm just wondering what you're working on at the moment, just quickly.
Okay, so I do have some short fiction coming out next year, a collection, so that'll have my novellas in there as well. And then at the moment I'm working on a book set in Java just before the Japanese invade World War II.
Well, I'll look forward to reading those. Thank you very much for your time
Thank
today.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
This episode features just one of over 70 speakers in our HNSA conference program. Our guest of honour is Geraldine Brooks. Other speakers include Stephen Carroll, Rosalie Hamm, and Kate Nunn, to name just a few. There'll also be special guest appearances from international best-selling authors Kate Quinn, Ben Kane, and Elizabeth Chadwick. You can find out more at hnsa.org.au. Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past.